Hey, I'm Brian Stelter. We're live here in New York, and this is Reliable Sources, where we examine the story behind the story, and we figure out what's reliable. This hour, Elon Musk, he wants to break up with Twitter, but can he? And if he walks away, who will stand up to buy the social media giant? Plus, weeks after the Supreme Court's ruling on abortion, is it still a top story in key states? We're going to speak with top editors in Texas and Georgia about that and more. And later, when the news seems so grim, what's the fine line between informing and overwhelming you? We're going to talk about that with Melissa Bell, Philip Bump, many more coming up. But first, how to decipher debates about disinformation. One of the dominant stories of our time is a dramatic drift toward a choose-your-own-reality environment. People are swimming, or perhaps drowning, in a sea of information, some of it straight-up disinformation, meaning something that's made up, on purpose, designed to deceive you. Disinformation is a real thing, a real problem, but it's almost impossible to have a conversation about it. This quote from the AP explains why. As trust breaks down, polarization and anxiety increases, creating opportunities for people pushing their own alternative facts. So in the case of disinformation, the term, a real thing, that term has been misused, weaponized, watered down, distorted, to the point that, as the New York Times said this week, disinfo has become yet another untouchable problem in Washington, D.C. And that didn't just happen by accident. It happened in the pursuit of power. Some progressives have overused the term disinformation, way overused it. Some conservatives have rejected the term altogether, even while spreading BS. Let's show some specific examples of this, okay? President Biden. He's had it bad enough lately without people lying about him. But here's PolitiFact checking a recent viral Facebook post claiming Biden was facing impeachment amid high gas prices. Of course, that claim was given a hard no, basically a pants on fire. But there's those sorts of claims every day. There was a viral video this week shared by anti-Biden commentators falsely claiming that he affixed a Medal of Honor backwards. The video was BS. This stuff happens seemingly every day now. It's become a part of the background. It's like humidity. It's always there. It just rises or falls. Republican politicians are targets of disinformation, too. And so are basically every major story in the news. Ever since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, there's been a copious amount of disinformation about abortions. Some experts are, quote, worried that abortion misinformation and intentional disinformation will only increase and make it harder for people to receive care. There are also national security implications to disinformation all around the world. That's why the U.S. Department of Homeland Security recently tried to create an advisory board, what it called a disinformation governance board. But that board quickly collapsed. It came under fierce criticism, including from Fox and right-wing media. The government did a horrible job of explaining what the board was supposed to do, and so it put it on pause, which is government speak for it's going away, it'll never come back. So, if the government can't even have a real conversation about disinformation, can't even have an advisory board to talk about it, that's a tough situation to be in. I thought Paul Barrett said it best. He's a deputy director for the Stern Center for Business and Human Rights at NYU. He told the Times, quote, "We're basically at this point unable to have a calm discussion about the problem. And there's a weird circular looping around effect. The problem itself is helping make us unable to talk about the problem." Think about that, right? The disinformation problem is making it harder to actually talk about the disinformation problem. Now, that sounds like a challenge. So let's take it on. Nina Jankowicz is the researcher who briefly led the Disinformation Governance Board before it collapsed. She's the author of books like How to Lose the Information War and the new book, How to Be a Woman Online. Nina, welcome to Reliable Sources. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
You've had a little bit of time to process what went wrong this spring when you briefly were the executive director of this board and then had it all fall apart. Let's just start with what was the goal? What was the Department of Homeland Security trying to do?
Well, the Disinformation Governance Board was a body that was meant to advise the many parts of the Department of Homeland Security that were working on disinformation, to bring best practices to bear and to make sure that we were up with the latest research, the latest trends in disinformation and countering it, and make sure that that work was being done in a way that protected freedom of speech, protected civil rights, civil liberties, and privacy. Now, what the Republicans and, frankly, some on the far left as well, well spun was that this Disinformation Governance Board was going to be a ministry of truth. There is no, absolutely no foundation for that, in fact. The Disinformation Governance Board was never meant to police speech. It was not going to police speech. And frankly, Brian, I have written and researched about government efforts to do just that. I am against them, just like many Americans are. And if that were part of the job description, I wouldn't have taken the job.
So the sympathetic view to you is that the Disinformation Board was the victim of disinformation. Is that how you feel?
Oh, it absolutely was the victim of disinformation. So all of these narratives that the Disinformation Governance Board was going to be this Orwellian Ministry of Truth, and all of the harassment and disinformation that was directed against me was based on that falsehood. Based on that falsehood that was knowingly peddled by many people in the conservative media ecosystem and on Capitol
okay.
Hill.
Why?
And frankly,
if that's true, what the heck was the Homeland Security Department doing? Why didn't they defend you? Why didn't you defend yourself? Why didn't the government explain what the heck it was doing?
Yeah, I have a lot of misgivings about the way things went down. And I think the first thing to point out, Brian, is that there was a disproportionate focus on me given my level of power within the department. I was not allowed to speak on my own behalf. And frankly, all the communications decisions that were being made about how to talk about the board were made above my pay grade and above my level of decision making. I was the executive director, but there were a lot of people that were involved that didn't take advice, frankly, that I had given them. And
I
had hoped that things would go down differently.
Look, I would start with the name. Just the name, right? Nina, it sounds Orwellian. Any PR professional would say, don't call it that, you know? They were just dumb mistakes made.
Right. And that belies the fact that it was meant to be an internal governing mechanism, governing how the Department of Homeland Security did its work on disinformation, not governing the internet. And that was one of the reasons that I ended up making the choice to resign, right? Because I felt like the government had just rolled over to the critics who had completely spun this narrative out of control based on absolutely nothing in reality. And the fact that they weren't able to defend me, the person that they had chosen, the expert that they had chosen to lead this board and safeguard this work. It just didn't feel like it was worth it, especially given
those
the
critics,
fact that my family was receiving threats.
And you were about to have a child, and I want to ask you about that in a moment. These critics, there were many of them. They were incredibly loud. They say you're just a giant liberal, could never be appropriately hired for this job because you posted disinformation on Twitter yourself.
Well, so there's a lot of things that to unpack in that. First, let's start with the idea that anybody would be someone that anybody on the political spectrum would want to be policing speech. Again, at the kernel of that criticism is the idea that this board would be policing speech, which it wasn't going to do. If that were the case, there would be no person nonpartisan enough, particularly in the counter disinformation sphere, who would appeal to everyone in that role. But I, you know, did not post disinformation. The folks that are honing in on tweets that I sent in 2016, when I had fewer than 1,000 Twitter followers, that, you know, I was just sharing information about a presidential election as it was happening, as millions of other Americans were doing, using their right to freedom of speech. That wasn't disinformation, right? It was just sharing news. Other people honed in on tweets that were, they completely stripped of context. The one that the conservatives loved to really amplify was a tweet that they claimed that made me seem like I was calling the Hunter Biden laptop disinformation, when in fact I was just live tweeting a debate, you know, saying the exact words that then candidate Biden and President Trump were saying during a debate. Totally stripped of context.
So you still
and
think you were the right hire?
Look further into the context.
So you still think
Absolutely,
you were the right
Brian,
hire
listen,
for the job?
Okay. Yes, I've done a ton of research over the past. Go ahead.
I was just going to. So you believe you were the right hire. The government screwed up with this thing. But now the question is, now what? Is the New York Times right that this is an unresolvable problem, that there's nothing Washington can do because Republicans and Democrats can't even agree on what disinformation is?
I don't think it's an untouchable problem. We've seen other countries with highly polarized media environments, for example, the United Kingdom, do really good work on this topic. But what we need is for our politicians to recognize that this is a democratic problem, small d, democratic problem. It knows no political party. Its ultimate victim is democracy, right? And we need those who are, frankly, benefiting from the political use of disinformation to recognize that they are putting our national security at risk and our democracy at risk. Someday, disinformation is going to come for them as well. And nobody wants that. We want people to be able to agree on facts and make well-informed choices at the ballot box. Ultimately, that's what's at stake here. And until we come to that reconciliation in Washington, then yes, it's going to be extremely difficult to do this work, as my own experience has shown.
When you say make informed choices at the ballot box, do you just mean vote for Democrats?
No, absolutely not.
Because that's often the criticism.
To vote.
That's the right's criticism, which is that disinformation is used as a weapon just to promote liberal agendas.
That's not true, right? We have seen, and I've even pointed out in Twitter, on Twitter over the past week, disinformation that has been used by the Democrats as well. We need to get back to a point where we are all, you know, putting the truth forward and that people want to know what the truth is. In my case, people didn't want to know what the truth was about me. They were told that I was the enemy and they were happy to do no further research in that regard and continue to badger me and my family rather than uncover my research, my writing, which has much more nuanced views and advocates for things like information literacy, certainly not policing speech, which again, I do not agree with.
So you have a newborn at home. What has this spring and summer been like for you, you know, as, you know, going through parenthood and seeing yourself destroyed, basically, in right-wing media?
Well, it was a pretty scary couple of weeks. I was in my last trimester of pregnancy, which should have been a very exciting time. And instead, my husband and I were making sure that, you know, our home was secure. It was not the end to a pregnancy that I had hoped. Luckily, our little guy is doing just fine. But people were not only, you know, disparaging and defaming me online, they were attacking my family. And some people, including Marjorie Taylor Greene, said that she felt sorry for my unborn child. That is a ridiculous place for our national discourse to be in. And, you know, again, I've advocated for all sorts of solutions to disinformation, but I think one of the things that we really need to get back to is a common humanity. I'm a person on the other side of my Twitter avatar. I have a family, I have a life, and I went into public service with a real desire to help the country. And so I think we all need to think about that. Next time we're having these anonymized arguments on social media, there are people on the other side of the screen. And the more that we can get back to that humanity in our politics and political discourse, I think the better our democracy will be.
Humanity, that's the word. Nina, thank you for coming on the program. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Let's continue this conversation now with our panel, Claire Atkinson, chief media correspondent for Insider, Philip Bump, national correspondent with The Washington Post, and Lauren Hirsch, a business reporter with The New York Times. The big overarching question here, Claire, and I don't know if any of us can answer it, is are there any actual solutions to the disinformation dilemma that she lays out, that we can't even talk about the problem in the same way?
Well, honestly, I feel like when I listen to British media, I feel like I'm getting reality. I don't feel that in the States.
You think it's an American problem? Interesting.
I think it's more exacerbated here. I think there's a shared reality of what the facts are in Britain. I listen to the BBC World Service before I go to bed at night. And I listen to it during, you know, political cycles, presidential cycles. And I feel like I'm getting what's really happening. And
so maybe we are more broken in the States here than elsewhere.
I think so.
Philip, how does that register with you?
I mean, I can't speak to the BBC World Service. I think it's interesting, obviously, the BBC is, you know, has ties to the government there. But the, you know, I mean, I think one of the disadvantages of the U.S. government here is it's uniquely disadvantaged by the fact that the First Amendment prescribes what it can and cannot do, right? And that is both useful and important. It's important to have the government not be able to draw those lines. And I think a key subtext of the interview you just had is, you know, who decides what that disinformation is? That's really the nutshell here. And if the United States government is saying this thing coming across from overseas or being said overseas is disinformation, that's the government making a judgment call about that. It may be absolutely accurate, but it is still the government weighing in on speech, not necessarily within our borders. But because of that disadvantage, it also allows bad faith actors to use that as an argument, as exactly was the case with this disinformation. They're able to say this is an affront to the First Amendment, even if it wasn't, because people understand that is something that the government ought not to be doing.
And all of this stems from distrust. All of this flows downhill from the distrust problem, a lack of trust in all institutions, including very much so the media. We can't talk about disinformation and pollution of the information without talking about trust or lack of trust.
Yeah. I mean, categorically, you know, and I think the statement about Marjorie Taylor Greene there, who has run, you know, has run multiple campaigns on being someone who is trying to sow distrust in the government, sow distrust in institutions, picking up on what Donald Trump did. Right. I think that's an important subtext.
Right. All right, Lauren, you're up first after the break. We have brand new reporting about Elon Musk and Twitter, what's going on with that deal, what Musk is saying about Twitter this weekend, plus the scoop about a Me Too moment for World Wrestling Entertainment. What's going to be revealed next?
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support. Your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome back to Reliable Sources. Elon Musk was in Idaho this weekend, spending time with fellow tech and media moguls at Allen & Company's annual Sun Valley Conference. And I'm going to tell you what Musk said in private to his fellow moguls. Musk, on Friday night, tried to back out of his deal to buy Twitter. He's been laying the groundwork for doing so for many weeks. You know, he's been complaining about the proliferation of bots and spam accounts on the platform that he said he wanted to buy. Remember, he agreed in writing to go ahead with that Twitter takeover, but now, as of Friday night, he's trying to back out. Well, he was at Sun Valley. He was at this hush-hush conference on Friday and Saturday, and he spoke on stage at a session that was treated as off the record. But I am told by a source who was in the room that he did talk more about the bots problem. Apparently, according to this source, Musk doubled down on his claims about bots all across Twitter. He said nobody believes, and this is paraphrasing, but he said nobody believes Twitter's claim that bots are under 5% of the total usage on Twitter. So he apparently went on about the deal. There are some headlines you're going to see out there saying he avoided the subject, but I'm told he did talk about Twitter. He tripled down on his decision to try to back out of the deal, and he's claiming it's about bots. Let's analyze that and more. Claire Atkinson, Philip Bump, and Lauren Hirsch all back at the table with me. Lauren, you've been covering this deal now for months. Just remind us how this started, because Musk originally said he was going to fix the bot problem, the same problem that he now says is stopping him from doing the deal.
So there was an interesting confluence of events where at the same time where the tech market basically dropped off a cliff, and that includes the value of Tesla, which is his main source of wealth.
Right.
All of a sudden, he also got really concerned about the bots and implied maybe that would be a reason why he might want to back out of the deal. Now, he would kind of throw daggers out there and then walk away, and we never quite knew what his intention was. The official launch to where we got to on Friday was his lawyer sent Twitter a letter and said, we think that you are withholding information that we need to close the deal. Hmm. And that started a 30-day window for Twitter to, in Musk's lawyer's mind, rectify the problem. And what happened on Friday was his lawyers alleged that they did not share sufficient information, and that, in their mind, gives Musk the ability to walk out of the deal now.
But Twitter says, no way, show us the money, we're going through with this, we'll see you in court.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Philip, is the bots thing just an excuse?
You give me the super hard question. Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to say. I mean, Elon Musk is an eccentric character, I think it's safe to say. I'm sort of fascinated by the repercussions of his announcement, that it very quickly became entangled in American politics, right? And, you know, he became seen as the savior of, you know, Twitter was seen as this sort of leftist, elitist organization. And then here comes this, you know, libertarian conservative to come in and take it over and then reshape it. And everyone got very excited about that.
Republicans were thrilled about
Absolutely.
Musk taking over Twitter.
Is Donald Trump going to come back now? Tucker Carlson deletes a tweet so he can go back on. So that, I think, is fascinating. And that remains unresolved. I think
he was a hero to Republicans,
right.
But now what? Last night on stage in Alaska, Trump said, Musk, he's just another BS artist.
That's right. Yeah, right. He's going to lash out at him because he has more money than he does, which is sort of his go-to. But I think that's unresolved, too. I don't know why Elon Musk did it, but it had very substantial repercussions politically that now remain unresolved.
And Claire, what's going to happen to Twitter? I mean, if he can get out of the deal, if it takes months or years, he may have to pay a $1 billion breakup fee. But this unresolved question is, what happens to this communications platform that you might love it, you might hate it, but it's one of the most important tools in the world?
Right. I mean, hanging out there right now is what happens to the employees, what happens to their advertising revenue, how do they keep moving ahead? We've been talking about this since April, and here we are in July, and those employees still don't know who the boss is going to be, who's going to own it. And I think if you're considering advertising on the platform, you want to know, is this brand suitable? What are their rules? What are they doing about policing misinfo? How's it going to be run in the future? And until I know the answers to those questions, why put my ad dollars there? So I think that's a big problem for Twitter.
Right. Mm-hmm. And there is, to be fair, a problem with bots. We don't know how big it is. Musk claims it's a lot bigger than Twitter says. I suspect part of what's going on here is Musk has a very different experience on Twitter than the average user. He is overwhelmed by BS replies and spam and all that. The average user, maybe not so much. But he has an unusual experience on Twitter, and that might be affecting this. By the way, speaking of Musk, your Upside Insider broke an interesting story this week. We'll put the headline on screen. Musk had twins last year with one of his top executives. Why so much baby drama with Elon Musk?
Well, he has stated, and he stated at Sun Valley this weekend, that he believes that the world has a problem with population growth and that he's doing his part.
A problem meaning we need more people.
We need more babies.
We need a lot more babies.
Yes, and Elon is doing his part there by having lots of babies.
Yes, he is.
And I think, at the heart of the discussion is that the nation seems to love talking about the world's richest man.
That's
And he loves everybody talking about him. And he loves to say and do things that keep him in the spotlight for whatever reason, whether it is, talking about populating Mars or putting computer chips in people's brains, which is something that they're exploring at Neuralink, one of the companies where he met the lady who had the babies. And so, I think almost the Twitter bid, part of the Twitter bid was about staying in the conversation in the same way that Donald Trump loves to stay in the conversation.
They're attention hackers. That's what they
Absolutely.
Are.
Absolutely.
Much more of the panel in just a moment. We're also going to turn to two top editors in states way outside New York and D.C. to find out what their readers care about most right now. Plus, does watching the news, reading the news make you feel powerless? A Vox publisher, Melissa Bell, is going to join me with ideas for what newsrooms can do to change that. Let's face it, there's a glaring, gaping disconnect in this country between what the media covers most and what the public cares about most. You can see it in this new polling from Monmouth University. The biggest concern facing families by a mile is inflation and other related concerns about the economy. Gas prices, inflation, the economy, all topping this list. This is really important data. It gives us a sense of what is on people's minds as they think about this midterm year. But is there a difference, and why is there a difference, between press coverage and the public's priorities? Let's get perspective now from outside the Beltway, beyond the Beltway. Atlanta Journal-Constitution Editor-in-Chief Kevin Riley is with us, and Dallas Morning News Executive Editor Catrice Hardy, also here. Thank you both for coming on. I find myself thinking about the January 6th hearings, which coming up again on Tuesday. Undoubtedly important. We learn more about the attack at every hearing. And yet, if we ask the average American, they are not as focused on the hearings, for example, as the economy. Catrice, what do you hear in Dallas and around in your community? And how do you try to make sure your front page is reflecting the public's priorities?
Well, no, we're in Texas, so national headlines come from Texas all the time.
True.
I think for us, it's really striking that balance, as you mentioned, inflation, that is huge here, as well as what's happening with reproductive rights and gun sales. You know, mass murders. We had one very recently here. So we try to make sure that when we're making these decisions on what we put online and what we put in our front page, that it's reflective of all of these significant issues playing out here.
So you mentioned the reproductive rights. We are several weeks since the Supreme Court ruling on abortion. You look at Mama's poll, you're going to only get 5% of people saying that's the top concern they have. Of course, people can juggle. They can have multiple concerns at once, and many do. But do you sense that abortion is a top issue for your readers?
Well, if you look at the number of people here who have gone out and protested, you know, who are concerned about these rights, we saw a lot of younger people out protesting this issue. And so if you think about connecting with voters down the road, these are the people who we need to get to come out and vote. So I do think it's an issue. But again, I think at the end of the day, when you're adding up your budget and you're looking at how you're going to spend your money, you know, what's going to drive you out to the polls and what are you most concerned about at the moment?
Yeah. Kevin, do you buy into what I'm saying about this disconnect that, you know, the press might focus more on January 6th, for example, than on pocketbook issues that Americans care about most?
Well, Brian, I think you are right in an important way. If you talk to people and you pay attention to polling, economic issues are always at the top of their list. I mean, when they're standing at that gas pump, filling up their car and seeing how much it costs, that's on their mind. It's something they live with every day. I still think, in the case of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution in Georgia, we have to bring some of those bigger issues, like the January 6th hearing, like the abortion decision, and other things, home to our readers and our digital users. Because, let's face it, the January 6th hearings, a lot of the characters are from Georgia. And I think, ultimately, voters in Georgia will care a lot about the role some of these folks have played, and they will come back to this. But it's different in day-to-day life when people are just trying to get to work, get their kids to school, get to the grocery store. Of course, economic issues are at the top of the list, and we have to pay a lot of attention to that.
I think we also think often about programming and writing for news junkies versus maybe more casual consumers, Catrice. I know you're relatively new to Texas. What has surprised you as a new Texas resident about that?
You know, I think at the end of the day, what we've learned is that our audience we pretty much can see what our audience is interested in and how they want us to want to consume our information. So one of the things we try to do quite often, and they tell us this, is let's break down these issues in ways that we can relate to. So helping them understand, you know, five reasons, for example, why they should care about reproductive rights, or they should care about gun sales. How do you bring a Uvalde home to the Dallas community? And that's how we try to approach all of our coverage.
Are you sensing news fatigue? This is something that researchers keep finding, that folks are just so exhausted by news stories. Is that true in Texas?
Absolutely, that's true. I mean, we see that across a number of issues. But again, you know, what can you do to really show them? I mean, this week, you know, the interesting story that made national headlines was, you know, the mother who was pulled over in an HOV lane. And being
able
to bring
that story
home.
Let's explain that. Explain that story to the viewers. It's amazing.
Absolutely. So we had a mother who was in a hurry to go get one of her children from school, I think preschool, and she was pulled over kind of in a random check of HOV lane drivers. And she said, well, I actually do have two people in the car, my baby. And so the officer kind of looked at her and said, well, what are you talking about? And, you know, her explanation was, with everything going on with Roe versus Wade, my baby is considered a living human being. And so he, of course, pulled her over. She still had a ticket, but they explained to her she probably could fight it. You know, her take on that is the governor has come out and said this is a massive victory for life. And so my baby is living. And so that'll be something that'll play out in court on July 20th.
Yes. And a lot of sites are now rewriting your story. But you all had it first, I think. You all deserve credit for that one.
Absolutely, yes.
Absolutely.
Our watchdog columnist did.
I know both of you think a lot about trust in media or lack of trust in media. Kevin, what is the most important thing your newsroom can be doing to try to regain the public's trust?
I think the best thing we can do is let people know and get a peek behind the curtain about how we do things. Our political reporters do a podcast, and in that podcast called Politically Georgia, which people can get at all the services, they explain why are we doing this story? How are we doing this story? Another thing we do, is, particularly when we do political profiles, as we've done with Herschel Walker, as you know, who's come across many complicated, difficult issues in his campaign, we always run a box along with that on our website in print that tells people, here's why we're doing this story. We have a responsibility to vet a candidate for the Senate. And I think if we keep working at things like that and tell people, here's why we're doing what we're doing, we gain trust. Plus, we remind people, Brian, that we live here. We're not national media parachuting in, but we go to church with you. Our kids go to school with your kids. We come to the ball game with you. We are vested in this community. And I think the more we emphasize that, more people believe us. And our own research tells us that we are more trusted than national media outlets. Mm.
Kevin and Catrice, thank you very much for the conversation. Good to see you both.
Thank you.
Good to be with you.
Up next, WWE CEO Vince McMahon reportedly paying millions and millions in hush money payments. Why is the story not getting more coverage? We're going to get into it next.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. There's been a ton of writing about the album Cowboy Carter since it dropped this spring. But what grabbed my attention is a new documentary on CNN called Call Me Country, Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Lots of artists have tried to boot scoot their way onto country music charts. Why did this album cause such a stir? And what about both this pop star and this political moment has caused all this conversation? Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
Now to the art of the follow-up, the need for follow-up stories. 3 weeks ago, Vince McMahon stepped down as WWE CEO following allegations of sexual misconduct. It turns out now there is a lot more to the story. The Wall Street Journal breaking the news this week that McMahon paid hush money, $12 million, to women who had made allegations against him. $12 million in payouts. That's a big scoop from the Wall Street Journal. Now there's probably more to come. There's an investigation that McMahon has pledged to cooperate with. But it's a really important example of why there needs to be digging by journalists to get to the fuller story. Let me bring back Claire Atkinson, Lauren Hirsch, and Philip Bump for more on all this. Claire, the WWE is a big media company. People sometimes don't appreciate how important it is in the media firmament. It's a content creation machine. What do you think are the implications of this revelation about McMahon?
Yeah, you'd have to wonder whether all of the WWE partners, whether it's Disney, whether it's Peacock, whether it's Fox, and Netflix also had a biopic of Vince in the works, which I read is now canceled. Like, what are they thinking? Are they thinking that this is just going to go away? The Wall Street Journal is already on its second story about Vince McMahon coercing a colleague into sex and then having to pay another couple of million dollars to the lady, and then she exited. I think, you know, the question is, does anybody care? This is a brand that operates in the wrestling ring.
Oh, gosh, that's cynical.
It's all about bad behavior,
this
right?
This is a Me Too story. In 2017, this would have been breaking news headline.
Absolutely, news. Absolutely. So the silence is pretty deafening. You also got to wonder, like, what exactly is this investigation that the board is doing? The board is made up of Vince McMahon's daughter, Stephanie McMahon, her husband, and also Erica Nardini, who's the CEO of Barstool Sports. So you kind of wonder, like, where this is really going. Stephanie was yucking it up at the UFC last weekend with her dad.
I appreciate the cynical. You're being a realist. Not a cynical, but you're being a realist.
I'm asking the questions.
Let me be a realist about another one, or a cynic about another story. Lauren, gas prices coming way down in the last couple of weeks. Of course, there was so much attention when gas prices are on the rise. We really focus on the bad news when it's happening. Is the media going to focus on good news of gas prices going lower?
It's funny. One of the tweets, I believe it was last weekend, that got the most attention was the back and forth between
Bezos, yeah.
Yep, and somehow everyone is quiet this weekend. So I know, I think that people tend to focus on the bad news, and certainly the Biden folks are tweeting about it. So they're trying to push the fact that it's down. Some people would say the price got too high. They've obviously been blaming the energy companies.
Right.
So it will be
right.
Interesting if they get traction in that message.
Right. Philip?
Yeah, I mean, look, people want to understand why bad things are happening, right? People sort of take why good things are happening for granted.
For granted, right?
People
right.
want to understand, like, why am I paying so much at the pump?
Yeah, that's a good point.
They don't really care as much why they're not paying as much. Biden wants them to care. Biden wants to say, here is why prices are going down, because he got so much blame for them going up. But right. it's just, you know, I mean, to your last segment, you know, what people care about is also driving something.
So big news out of the UK this week, of course, Boris Johnson under incredible pressure and now stepping down. What's the media angle here, Claire?
Well, I think the question people are asking now is who's going to be the next Prime Minister of Britain and who will get to influence how the Conservative Party votes on that topic. And in years gone by, Rupert Murdoch, the press barons like Lord Rothermere, who runs the Daily Mail, would have a huge influence in that, whether it was Tony Blair or Margaret Thatcher. You know, the view was they could put their thumb on the scale and really influence how the British population voted. I don't think that's true anymore. The newspapers, you can still find 12 newspapers on a stand in the UK, but not as many people are reading them. Websites are more influential. The biggest one is the BBC, followed by the Daily Mail, which gets something like 25 million readers.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to what extent do the press barons really have an influence on how politics plays out in the UK? I think
interesting.
Is the question.
Waning influence. Mm-hmm. And Philip, the stunning assassination of Japan's Shinzo Abe, a country where gun violence basically doesn't exist. Was it difficult this week for the American media to convey just how different the gun landscape is between Japan and the U.S.?
I mean, I think it's difficult simply because it's almost literally night and day. I actually have the numbers here. The number of guns owned in the United States per million people is about 1.2 million. So Americans own about 1.2 million guns for every million people. In Japan, the number's 2,400, right? I mean, it's just staggering. The number of gun homicides in the United States is about 58 per million. In Japan, it is 0.007. per million, right? Like, it's absolutely starkly different. That may have actually helped play a role in Abe's death, where the security simply wasn't prepared for someone with a gun.
Maybe couldn't imagine
but it's hard to convey because it's literally almost the exact opposite situation.
That's why I'm glad you made charts to show this on WashingtonPost.com. We have to show people those numbers. To the panel, thank you, everybody. We've got more coming up, including an interview with Vox publisher Melissa Bell. She's challenging the journalism world to help people feel empowered and not so powerless. Journalism's role is to inform the public, not to alarm, to inform. But when there are so many grim news stories, so many disturbing news cycles, does it drive audiences away? And what can be done about that? I mean, think about some of the headlines this summer, everything from inflation to continuing COVID cases, innumerable mass shootings, the continuing war in Ukraine. There are so many stories out there that might leave audiences feeling powerless. My next guest has some thoughts about that, maybe some solutions. Her name is Melissa Bell. She's the publisher of Vox, and she's here with me now. And I'm stealing your word. You've been using the word powerless. I saw you speaking about this at a conference last month. Tell me what you mean when you say viewers might feel powerless by all this news.
Sure. Well, I actually pulled the word from a Reuters digital news report that was published this year. It's, I think, one of the most informed research pieces that comes out every single year. They interview over almost 100,000 people across the world in 46 countries. And what they found, unsurprisingly, is that there's a lack of trust in the media.
Yeah.
That's given. We've known that for over three decades, that trust in institutions is falling.
It's getting worse and worse. But here's the report. What the report now says is people are trying to avoid the news.
That's what I find much more frightening. What happens for a business person in the news business when your audience doesn't actually want to pay attention to your product? More so, what happens when you don't have an informed citizenry that wants to participate in democracy by understanding and learning about the news every single day? I think that this is a real call to journalists everywhere, to news organizations everywhere, that we need to be thinking about our product differently because we're turning people away in big numbers. Over 42% of the U.S. population say that they actively avoid the news. That's a major issue.
So you're saying change the product. In what ways?
There's so many ways. I can't count all of them, but I'll just start with a few. I think that we aren't building a service for our audiences. We're not actually helping them navigate the world around them. What we're doing is we're telling them horrible, frightening news every single day and not providing any solutions. One area that I think is a good example is when our early COVID coverage, I think we saw a rise of trust in the media at that point in time because we were trying to help people navigate a very real life and death situation.
Right, good point.
We took our job seriously to provide a service to our audience. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that we do that with other stories.
Yeah, there's a herd mentality in journalism. And you say also we like to cover the new part of news, but not the rest.
Yes. We often jump onto a story. I think that you see this when a major breaking news event happens. You'll have thousands of journalists go to cover a story and then descend on a town like Flint, Michigan, and cover the water crisis for a few weeks, a month at most, and then disappear. And they don't think about, should we start a water beat? Should we be covering the other dozens of towns in America that are suffering from outdated infrastructure? Mm. We're not talking about policies that can impact and change that problem. It's much more about the thrill of the moment of breaking news versus the actual concerted effort to change coverage.
So what are you doing at Vox to change that?
We're doing a number of things. We started Vox really to help people understand the news. That was the first thing that we started thinking about 8 years ago. How do we help people understand what's happening, the context, the historical context? But now we're thinking more and more, not just about how to help people understand, but what to do with the next step when they have the information. What can they do with that
what
information?
What can they do? That is really the key, isn't it, right? What can you do with the information?
Right.
Can you affect any change at all?
Well, I think that you can. I mean, I think that one of the things that we talk about a lot is that too much political coverage is taken like a sports coverage. It's a game to people. The politicians are characters in the game. There's winners, there's losers. But actually, politicians are paid employees of the American public. What are we doing to give them a job review? How are they doing? What's the performance of their job? When you have
That's
something
good point.
Like gun control, who is succeeding and who is failing to make any progress with something that over 90% of the population agrees needs to change?
Hmm. Melissa, thank you for bringing this up. It's a great conversation starter, I think, for newsrooms.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
More reliable sources here in just a moment. Finally this hour, an update on the Philippines news website Rappler. Last week, we spoke with Maria Ressa about the government's attempts to shut her down. This week, another setback, Ressa losing an appeal for her cyber libel conviction. Now she's heading to the country's Supreme Court, trying to stave off years of potential prison time. Rappler said in a statement that democracy depends, quote, on a media that is not threatened by the state, nor intimidated by forces that are out to silence critical voices. They're right, and that's a global story. Hold the line. We'll be back this time next week for more Reliable Sources.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.